Welcome, new and familiar listeners. I'm Lana. Thanks for joining me. With me is a lovely and talented Brittany Pettibone, who is the co-author of the sci-fi fantasy novel Hatred Day, which was co-written with her identical twin sister. We'll talk about Trump's inauguration, her political journey, and what it means to be an American nationalist. Then we dive into the genre of sci-fi fantasy, which is being riddled with cultural Marxist programming. And we talk about her sci-fi fantasy novel and how it differs. This interview is available in both video and audio format. Go to redice.tv and click on Radio 314 to find this show. Brittany Pettibone, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Such a pleasure.
Well, you have an identical twin sister. Nicole is her name. So what's it like having a twin sister? Are you guys as connected as people say? It's almost like a paranormal thing that happens.
Well, so many people, you would not believe how many people have genuinely asked us the question, can you read each other's minds? So many times I've gotten this question. It's absolutely amazing. But to be honest, we were very close when we were young, maybe till age 8 or 9. And then we kind of had a falling out. We weren't really friends for many years. It got so bad that when we were in 10th grade, Nicole actually went to boarding school in New York and I stayed in California. And eventually we bonded through writing. So we're very different, but we're complementary. You could say that we're opposites that complement one another. So that worked very well professionally in writing because, yeah, the way we work together, it's very complementary. But we're very close now, and we have been for the past several years, but it was just interesting because there was a time when we weren't. And I actually do know several other sets of twins, and many of them aren't close at all. So I guess it just depends.
So it's kind of a fantasy in the movies that they show, like you can read each other's thoughts and feel each other or choose the same colors or clothes, right?
Right.
Yeah. And you also live in California. So what's it like there these days? I lived there for quite a time, but that was a little while ago and it was still being affected by mass immigration. But what's it like these days?
These days? Well, the same. Yes, it's hugely being affected by immigration. Everything is in Spanish as well as English. And here's an example. A little while ago, my mom was called into jury duty. And so she went in and 3/4 of the people there were let go, were excused because they couldn't even speak English.
Oh,
so it's getting extremely, to the point where we need to reevaluate. But, Trump has promised to deport all the illegal immigrants, hopefully the criminals, first. And I think it'll be a lot better. But in certain places in California, like the rural agricultural places, there are still a lot of conservatives. There are still a lot of good people. It's not that California is completely rotten. Of course, there are places where it is. The cancer has gotten so bad that it's almost irreversible. But I think there is hope for certain parts. It's just a question of, as a whole, can we save California? And probably not at this point.
So what do you think about Calexit? I mean, I think that's a great idea, but you live there, so maybe not so much.
Yes, I don't know. I just feel so bad about surrendering it,
Yeah.
I think that if we deport a lot of the illegal immigrants and the people on H-1B visas who are taking away jobs from, hardworking Americans, that would make a drastic difference. It would make a massive difference. And I think if we take those steps, then we'll see. But just going straight to Calexit, I feel like is too much of a surrender, without a fight. But if need be, then I guess I would just move. I'm not so in love with California that I could never move. I actually have recently been considering moving, so I'd probably be gone before any such thing happens.
Yeah, it would probably just go communist and then fall apart. But what I want to know is, okay, so if you guys intend to break off, are you going to have borders or can anyone just come live there? So how would that work?
Exactly. Well, I imagine that the people who would mainly move there, they are not in favor of borders. They're, advocate for the multiculturalism. So I imagine they'd be overrun pretty quickly.
So I know you were in D.C. for the inauguration of Trump. So how did it go? What was your experience?
My experience was absolutely wonderful. So from day one, I was pretty much on the Trump train. And I said to myself that if Trump wins, I'm 100% going to the inauguration. I have to go. So it was last minute, though, that I decided because I didn't have everything in order. But I did end up growing, and it was wonderful because there's so many people that I've met online, the pro-Trump, you know, social media network. And it was so wonderful because I was able to meet pretty much all of them. I attended the Deplorable, so I met many there, but then also in different areas, like we would go to bars and things like that. And I was able to meet them all, and that was amazing. But then also the inauguration was very, I mean, it's a once in a lifetime thing. You had to almost, like, it's just, I'm unable to explain what it felt like standing there, listening to him give his inauguration speech, which was an amazing speech, by the way, but just with all the thousands of Trump supporters around, it was interesting because there were a lot of protesters who tried to infiltrate and they kept screaming and trying to make, so we couldn't hear his speech. So there was kind of little fights breaking out, but nothing violent. The violence, I know it was there on Inauguration Day heavily, but it was avoidable. There were some people who got caught up in it because they were going in trying to get footage for Twitter or whatever it may be, but it was perfectly avoidable. And I personally was very glad to see, though, that these protesters, over 200 of them, were arrested and they were heavily fined, and also they're going to be sentenced to up to like 10 years in prison.
I hope so.
Yeah.
That's great. We need to set a precedent for that. I know.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I don't know if you saw some of the footage, but there were Antifa types that are open communists just marching the street of America with their hammer and sickle, you know, talking about killing people that weren't communists.
Exactly.
What did you think when you saw some of that footage?
When I see those people, my immediate thought is, please move to China where your ideology matches theirs, but stop trying to change, you know, our constitution and our freedom-loving society, because these people obviously have no real understanding of what communism is. If they did, they wouldn't want it.
It's mass, you know, murdered more people than any other in history, but that's the thing. A lot of these new communists, these new American Bolsheviks, they love violence. They're not even hiding it anymore, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. They're just anarchists.
And it's funny that you say China too, because I was like, I don't think China would let them, because they have an immigration policy, a pretty strong one in place. Yeah, exactly. You can't just go there and become Chinese, right?
Yeah.
That's funny. So also, what did you think about Trump? And this is new news actually today. He's been really busy signing executive orders. Have you been following the news on that?
Yes, I have a little bit. I've been sleeping a lot since I got home because I'd hardly slept the whole time. But yes, I have been following it. To an extent. And it's wonderful. It's seeing, you know, having a president that's actually doing what he promised. It's unbelievable. And it shouldn't be, because they, you know, our president should follow through on what he promises. But he's just like every day, you know, he's doing more and more. You know, it's like, it's going to be, how much is he going to have accomplished by the time the 4 years are up? It's going to be unbelievable.
It's amazing how these lefties are freaking out on his immigration policy. It's like, he's just enforcing, he wants to enforce laws that are already in place. I mean, that's something that the left hasn't been doing all these years, you know?
Yeah. And it's really funny how to witness how much they are, you know, losing their minds over this, because it should have been anticipated. He said that he was going to do it. Maybe they're just used to Obama, who would promise things and then would not actually follow through. But they seem so shocked that he's actually doing it. I mean, admittedly, I was shocked that he was so quickly getting down to business. He's just so no nonsense. I love it. But I think that's why it's just interesting to see how shocked they are.
So what are the top things you want Trump to get done as president?
Oh, so many things. Off the top of my head, though, I'd say restoring law and order, supporting our military and our police force, giving them the freedom and the tools they need to do what they have to do to keep our country safe, because that's just gotten completely out of hand. Then also deporting the illegal immigrants, particularly the criminals. I would love to see him actually build the wall, bring back jobs in manufacturing. That would be huge. And then one of the largest he could possibly do, in my opinion, is education reform. We need to just like rip out by the roots all this cultural Marxist propaganda from our education system. I don't know, maybe start teaching love of country and patriotism for once. You know, all these people that are so anti-America. But to add to that, I do believe that Trump can get a lot done that's very positive for our country. But I think we do have to keep in mind that political revolutions like the one we've seen with Trump, they don't ever really bring about lasting change. because they are the overthrowing of an institution. So I think if we truly want to bring about significant and permanent change, to have a permanent impact on society, we need to bring about a revolution of thought or manners. You know, similar to how cultural Marxism, that revolution completely took over and it's completely transformed our country, Western civilization. So they're two very different kinds. And I think we have the opportunity now to do that, you know, especially with all these different groups rising up, you know, these grassroots organizations that are, you know, very pro America, actually, you know, that are patriots, nationalists, you know. So we do have an opportunity now, but we need to take it because its timing is very important and we're not going to have this chance that we have forever.
Now, you know, part of America is, and people always want to deny this nowadays with all the cultural Marxist indoctrination, but it was European people that founded this country, right? So America has always been really European. So are you quite shocked by a lot of the anti-white rhetoric that just seems to be okay nowadays everywhere you go?
Yes. And it almost seems maybe they were priming it for a while and it wasn't as blatant because, or maybe I just haven't been as aware. Because I feel like it's almost been in the past year or 9 months that the anti-white rhetoric has really come to fruition. It's everywhere, you know, and it's extremely blatant. You know, BuzzFeed is like anti-white all the way. You know, a lot of these mainstream media news outlets, I wouldn't really call BuzzFeed that, but no. they do have like a cultural impact, I would say. Yes, but it's everywhere. And you can't speak out against it. Like I did make a video on it. I used to make some videos on a channel that I don't do anymore, but I did do one on the rise of anti-whiteness. And I got a lot of heat for that because it's like, how dare you even suggest that there's such a thing as, you know, racism against white people. But so it was interesting to gauge that. But yes, I do notice how that is prevalent. And it's a good that we're fighting back against it, that we're raising our voices against it, because if not, it would completely consume everything so fast.
Oh, yeah. Then they'll pretty soon just be, if we don't have any kind of pushback now, they'll just be openly calling for the genocide of all Europeans. And then it'll just be perfect, right? then our culture and our country will be perfect without white people. Well, so tell us about your political journey to where you are now. I mean, were you always a Republican?
Actually, well, I've never really identified as Republican. I've always been more conservative than Republican. So before Trump, I always believed that Republicans were as corrupt as Democrats, and that no matter what they said, you know, behind the scenes they were having, you know, dinner together and shaking hands, you know. So I believe they were working towards the same globalist regime essentially. So I only currently identify as Republican because Donald Trump was running for president and won the election. So, you know, for example, I would have never voted for Bush or Romney. The last election was the first time I was able to vote, and I voted for Ron Paul. So,
more of a libertarian background, more so.
Well, I would describe myself as a constitutionalist and then an American nationalist. So,
now, usually what American nationalist, what does that mean to you? I mean, that's always controversial these days because people are like, oh, it's code for white nationalism. What is it to you?
It's not though. It's. I mean, I interchangeably all use patriot and nationalist. It's just it's a love of country and wanting to protect and preserve what our country is. We're, you know, with open borders and, you know, the push for multiculturalism, it threatens our country's security and identity. So nationalism, it's about wanting to preserve that identity of our country and, you know, loving your country and doing anything for it and not having allegiance to other regimes. So, I mean, that's just how I've looked at it. And I think it's very simple and I don't find it controversial in any way. And so when people say that nationalist, you know, you're suddenly a white supremacist or something of the nature, it's very confusing. I think that if we look back, we can see how many times the left has tried to take our words and redefine them, and we've allowed them to. So nationalist is one of those words that's in danger of being redefined and, you know, allowing them to take that from us. We can't let them take our words.
Well, it's interesting, too, how they don't go after Chinese nationalists for being Chinese supremacists or, you know, Israeli supremacists. This only applies to European people in European countries, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, some people, they're bothered by the thought of some white people are of major demographic change, of becoming a minority in America. Does that bother you at all? Or are you one of those that's like, oh, I'm okay if I was a minority here?
Well, of course, I wouldn't like to see the whites become a minority. Yeah, of course not. But the thing is, and I've said this a few times in interviews I've done, I do think that if we do become a minority, it's entirely our fault. And it's something we have to take responsibility for, because we are the ones who are choosing not to have children, choosing to abort our children, or, you know, not have kids at all, you know, through contraception. So it's up to us if we want to, you know, revitalize, you know, the idea of the nuclear family, having lots of children and having strong units, you know, family networks and society. That's what's going to make us strong and, you know, actually progressive. So I think that, it's not, you know, because it's not like they're coming through and genociding us all, you know, killing all the white people. It's us. We're almost being tricked. It's like a mind game. Mm-hmm. And we're being, you know, told, oh, it's so much more fun. Just go live your life. Don't have kids. You know, don't take responsibility, all these things. And so, of course, it might be easier and more fun. But at this point, we do need to look at having children as a duty. Yeah. Because otherwise, we're going to, we're going to die out. We're going to become the minority. So, But yes, of course, I would not like to see that happen at all.
Well, and to switch gears now, you're also a sci-fi fantasy author, a genre I'm a huge fan of too. My last guest and I, Bree, we spoke about how the sci-fi fantasy genre is really adding lots of diversity and cultural Marxist themes. But have you noticed a change in a lot of sci-fi fantasy books and movies lately?
Yes, 100%. Particularly so, I write in the young adult genre, which is it's the largest and most lucrative genre at the moment. So what you can do is there's a whole list of literary agents that you can go through and query them your story. But all of these agents have sort of checklists, like, I'd like to see this in my mailbox, you know, so if you've written a book like this, please query me. And so these checklists always include such things as diversity, you know, open borders, multiculturalism, feminism. They want the strong female character. Yeah. And by strong, they mean, you know, physically kick-ass, kind of like that. So, yes, but they all include this. And then they like a lot of LGBT as well right now. So if your book includes any of these themes or, you know, these types of characters, then they 100% want to see them.
Mixed species, gay, alien sex. I'm serious. I was like, I put on an episode of Defiance and that's what it was, like, you know, gay alien sex. And then it was like, too, like the blondest of the blondest alien later on hooks up with a black guy, of course. You know, it's like they have to have that in there. Yeah, but there's like lots of gay stuff that's in a lot of the sci-fi movies now. Mm-hmm. Dark Matter, Expanse, Defiance, all very multicultural now, pushing, you know, open borders. It's part of this whole liberal fantasy land utopia. And it's just really ridiculous. That's why I can't even watch it anymore. I put on a couple of these just checking it out for the first time. And I was like, thank you. It's so obvious what's happening. And then exactly the female driven lead, like in the Divergent series or Hunger Games. And they're always fighting against, you know, the evil white male patriarchy, right? Yeah. To bring open borders and, you know, save the world. It's just so ridiculous.
Right. Exactly. And I mean, it's getting more and more militant. I was looking through on the Twitter accounts of some of the old book bloggers who I used to be friends with before I came out for Donald Trump. And some of them have like retweeted some articles that other bloggers had written about. Like you can go through this article and make sure that you've committed no microaggressions with your writing, that, you know, things. And I'm like, how do you get to this point? Like, how do you function? I would go insane having to check, you know, down to such minute details to make sure that I'm not offending anyone. but I feel like it also destroys the ability to be creative. That's why maybe we're not seeing any more original, innovative ideas. It's all just remakes or nothing original anymore, because you're so restricted into this box. There are so many rules, more and more and more and more, that you're just afraid even to think outside the tiniest box anymore, or take any kind of risk. And that's what I see happening. And it's very sad, because you know, art is a reflection of culture. And if our art, it's total dirt at this point, because we're not able to put out anymore, or those who want to do it and take that risk are not given the platform, then we're not going to see any more good art.
And yeah, it's the same crappy liberal themes in all these books and movies now. It's like, come on, you think you're artists and you guys aren't even taking a risk. You're just doing the same thing that everyone else is doing. But imagine if it was more nationalist based, right? Like pushing like, oh, these people, they're so happy to be part of their tribe. And I think that would actually be refreshing. I think people would actually say, hey, this is something new. I really like this. I think it would sell pretty well in this day and age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I definitely think that we have an opportunity to do that. If we stop, you know, being so, I think we've reacted to the left too much. I think we need to, of course, we need to keep reacting to them and, you know, fighting them, but we also need to just focus on what can we do on our own, completely remove the left from the equation, and what can we build, you know, because there's so many of us. We know now that there are. We all voted for Trump. We all obviously want to see some kind of change. So there are so many of us. So we all just need to get together.
Yeah,
and
it's
build,
a culture war.
Building.
It's a culture war, and we're meeting lots of artists and actors and writers and all kinds of talented people, and you're one of those people, so I wanted to play a trailer from your book. Right, so tell us more about the plot in Hatred Day.
Well, yeah, the general premise is what you saw is essentially to save her family from execution. The protagonist, Nofred, she has to act as bait in a hunt that will bring wealth and fame to all who survive. So it's a very legendary, large hunt. But and then that's the main premise, but we do have several subplots that go on. So there's a lot more to the story. Essentially, the book begins with Snowfred realizing that she has selective amnesia. So someone has stolen all of her memories of people. So she still knows what things are, like she knows what a car is, or a house, etc. But she doesn't remember any of the people in her life. And so it's about her putting together the puzzle of her past and realizing that she is involved with and connected to, you know, people in the highest levels of government and in society, many of which are human, because Snowfred herself, she is an inborn, which is an alien race that we created that had come to Earth a few decades before the book begins. So she is an alien, an inborn, living amongst humans, trying to, but, you know, secretly, because they're at war with humans. When the book begins.
Have you gotten into some of the kind of ancient aliens theories? Have you researched any of that at all? Like Anunnaki theories and the Nephilim?
No, we haven't really. We actually just, we call them aliens because we don't really know what else to call them. Just because they're from a different dimension, that's why. But it's not, you know, they look completely like humans, except for the fact that they have powers. So That's the difference between them. But we spent 9 years writing this, planning this series, because it's going to be 7 books. So we spent 9 years before we even published the first book. So it's all planned down to the most minute detail. And if you visit our website, you can see we've written a lot out there already about the species that we created and our world and our government, the politics, everything. It's all, and we're going to add so much more when book two comes out, but that's all we could add for now. But you know, we put so much work into it. Yeah.
Well, the tagline is humanity is unified against the inborns, an extraterrestrial species with godlike intelligence and abilities. His arrival on Earth caused an environmental and biological crisis. So to me, this almost seems like a veiled message for what's happening in our society today. And I know you can't give away too much without giving away your storyline, but did you have any parallels with kind of more modern political and social themes in mind while writing this story?
Yes, definitely. And we have a lot that are going to come out more in the later books. We tried to keep it more subtle in book one, just because we were trying to get traditionally published for a while. And so we were trying to not be as blatant. But one of the through line, one of the main questions that we ask through the entire series, and that we do give a fair shot to, you know, we show both sides, is can two, you know, dominant races, neither of which is willing to assimilate to the other, can they coexist? Or do you need to have that separation?
Yeah, because so that's one. United in hate, right? It kind of makes me feel like, oh, geez, you know.
Yeah.
It's gee, like, who's united against hate against who right now on the planet, right?
Yeah. It's the tagline in the year 2052. It's not love, but hate that unites the world. So the way I looked at it was, you know, humans, they never get along unless they have a common cause, you know, something to fight for. So all of the humans basically on Earth are united in hate against the inborns who have essentially come and they're another dominant race. And they're fighting for Earth, basically. And
it almost seems like, too, the inborns, they're kind of more tribal. They stuck to their own people more so, right? They're almost like nationalists. And almost, I kind of got the feeling of, too, it was a war against, well, basically eugenics, right? The beautiful, the intelligent, the strong. That's what the inborns are.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We also, another thing that we wanted to put in that I suppose it's a little less subtle is, Nicole and I have always been anti-feminist. So we noticed that in the young adult industry, many of the protagonists were female and were very feminist. So it was more about the way that they defined a strong woman in all of these books was someone who could go out and beat up a man, you know, who could kick ass. And to us, that's never been what we've striven for. It's been, so we tried to make our protagonist Snowfrid be strong through, she would defeat her opponents through intelligence and wit, you know, having to survive and win, you know, using her mind as opposed to physically.
You mean she doesn't take on a 300-pound guy and kick his ass? What? That's unheard of. She's like
and 110 pounds. And in the situations that she does have to physically fight, it's always, you know, very difficult for her. So it's just, it's realistic. And we always admired that in women. So, you know, there are certain characters like from, I don't know, Lord of the Rings, you could say, like, and they would rely less on being physically strong. Or like, what's it, the Wheel of Time series, you know, it would be their minds. And we just, we liked that.
Yeah, there's a power in femininity, and it's not about fighting on the battlefield, fighting guys on the battlefield. Exactly. I was going to say, how does your female lead differ from other, you know, these, you know, female lead, empowered female roles in movies and books right now? But does she have any traditional kind of aspects there too?
Yeah, exactly that. She relies, we made it so we created the character web, the web of opponents. We created them in a way where she had to conquer them mentally. They would all of them attack her, you know, from all these different angles all the time, but through, they're not coming at her usually trying to like cut her head off or something. They are trying to blackmail her, and she has to find a way using her mind out of that, you know. So that's how we tried to do it differently, because it was a lot more complicated that way. We felt that it made for a more interesting story as well. So that's what we did with Snowfrid. And there's nothing against, you know, the female character who can go through and, you know, kick ass or whatever. But just as presenting that as the goal for women, you know, as what all women should be and what makes a great woman and a strong woman, and that nothing else can, you know, I 100% disagree with that. And I saw everyone doing it. They're all doing the same thing. And, you know, this is what makes a great woman. And so we wanted to give a different perspective. Definitely, that's what we tried to do with her.
Yeah, and in your case, you have to write what you know. You can't sit here as a young woman and write a guy character and kind of know what he's going to go through, right? It's more appropriate for a woman to write about another woman, of course.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we do have men, though, that we have written from their perspective. And I feel like that we've done an okay job because we haven't gotten any complaints yet. But we'll see. Yeah, I actually, it's weirdly enough, we almost prefer writing from the male perspective. I'm not sure why. It's just easier for us.
Simpler, maybe.
Yeah, I would say so. But there's one character in particular who has always been my favorite. His name is Lycidius. And it's funny, the women usually like that character when they read the book. And then there's another one called Hadrian, and the men usually like him, which is more Nicole's character that she created more and put more into. So yeah, it's interesting.
Maybe she wrote even her ideal man, what she wants to see. She wrote it into the character, right?
Oh, well, I don't know about him. Okay. He's pretty out there. He's going to have an arc, though. That's what we like to do with our characters. Like, none of them are perfect. We try to give them as many imperfections as possible, particularly because our series is so long. So they can start one place, and by the end of the series, you'll see how drastically different they've changed. So they have a very complete arc. And yeah.
Now, you received over 200 rejection letters. And in these days in, you know, self-publishing and self-promotion, like, who cares what these publishers, you know, who cares what they like and don't like? A lot of them are just liberals. You know, it's a small cabal that controls things. Now, what was your experience in dealing with publishers? Do you think maybe some of your politics wasn't up to speed for them, what they wanted in a book or what?
Yeah, so these rejection letters, the 200, we received them over the course of several years because we, you know, we would try and query too early or whatever and then realize we weren't ready, but we did receive so many. And I think the main reason we did, I'm not 100% sure if they could detect that we were more conservative. I know that when you opened our book, there weren't all the same liberal messages that a lot of other books would have right off the bat, like from page one. But I think that the main complaint was that our book wasn't simple enough. Okay, so you've read The Hunger Games, right, I assume?
I haven't read it, but I know about
the
movie.
Well, if you open The Hunger Games and read the first couple pages, you'll see how simple it's written.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like...
written for dumb people, right?
it's so incredibly simplified. Yeah. So if you write in a way that's a little more complex... and it's not even complex. I wouldn't say that it's complex, but just they want to read the most simple,
dumbed down
simple things.
Yeah.
And so it's that, but it's also instant gratification. Like normally and traditionally books were written where you would take the time to set the scene so there would be a payoff later. Like you're not automatically going to love a character, so you can't put them in danger in the first second, from page one, because you don't care about them. You want to kind of take some time to establish things for a payoff later and build up to. But most agents want to see, like, you have to hook the reader, you know, within the first paragraph. And it's like, it's just almost insanely, you know, it's this mental gymnastics you have to do. Like some people spend months writing page one. They expect so much.
It's all part of our ADD society and star-driven movies where they don't even talk anymore. Some girl just stands there with her puckered up lips and they film her for 5 minutes and that's it, you know, and a car blows up.
Yeah, so that was the main difficulty there. But I think that had we written the book for adults, it would have been easier to get published. But the fact that we wrote it for young adults, so they like more simple stories. So, but then Nicole and I noticed it was really funny because people in Europe, they all love our book. They love it. And it's so easy for them to read and they understand. And it's just a weird thing to compare to that the youth in America find it more difficult to understand.
Definitely more ADD going on here in America than Europe, I definitely think. Also, you were saying too, before you were thinking of, you know, writing, kind of tailoring it for the publishers to like it. Well, I think that success comes when you just kind of just get that out of your mind and just tear the ceiling back and just say, whatever, I'm going to write what I like. Screw all of you all, right?
That's exactly what we decided to do because we had 6 literary agents who were interested during the last draft that we had written and right before we wanted to publish. So at the last minute, we wrote them and said, actually, we want to self-publish because we wanted to just do what we wanted to do, get it out there, publish it, and then hopefully we would see enough people buy it and enjoy it so that we could approach a publisher later and kind of get it done on our terms. That was, you know, we were trying that for a while. It was still very difficult. We actually did get some great awards from Kirkus. One of the big review companies gave us one of the best indie books of the year. So that was a huge thing, but it didn't help and to the extent that we wanted to, because it was very hard to break into the young adult kind of click group. Because how they do it now is they have all the traditional publishing companies, which all have deals, you could say, or with a lot of or working professional relationships with a lot of the booktubers on YouTube, and so who review all the young adult books, and they all have large followings. So the publishers send the books to them, and they review them and put them out and get a lot of people to buy them. So as a self-published author, most people think self-published equals crap. And, you know, to be fair, a lot of times it does. But so a lot of these book bloggers and reviewers, none of them want to touch self-published books. So they won't review it for you. So it's very difficult to get it out, the word out.
Nowadays, I think, you know, self-published is code for good book, good book with good themes that we probably would like, because none of these, the publishing cabal doesn't want to touch it, doesn't want to promote it, right?
Right, exactly.
Now, you guys have another book coming out in 2017. Was it Verdict Day? Tell us about that one.
Yes, Verdict Day. That is the second book in the Hatred Day series. So unless you've read the first one, the synopsis of the second one will be more difficult to understand. But it is about a trial, a long trial that we've been researching all about trials. Like, of course, we're not doing it exactly how the humans would do it because it is an inborn trial, but that's what it is, mainly the second book. And then the third one, interestingly enough, will be about an election. So we had a lot of inspiration from this election cycle that will definitely be going into that book.
Now, I'm curious, just speaking and thinking in terms of women again, what are some of the pros and cons you'd say of women in your age group today?
I think one of the large pros is that, and this is just my opinion, but I feel like women my age are at the stage in their life where they have the ability to be the most influential. And this can be just as much of a con as it is a pro, depending on what you believe. You know, if you're a bad influence, then of course it's going to be negative. But I do think that more people are willing to listen and you have more opportunity and more of an ability to put something out into the world and be successful in that regard. But then I think also that the pros and cons will change depending on the type of woman you're talking about. So, I mean, if you're a conservative woman, then a con would be that it's almost impossible to be successful in any major industry if you are publicly conservative. Or another con, maybe a personal one, would be that it's very difficult, I feel, to meet like-minded individuals in our age group. Since I've come out for Trump, I found that it's difficult for like-minded men and women to find each other. And that's something I've noticed. And I do think that they've been, in a sense, given an outlet through the Trump movement. They've been able, some people, to meet each other. But I do think that we need something new, you know. And I'm glad that we're seeing more of them, you know, outlets and platforms where these people can meet each other, because we do need, you know, something like Trump. Everyone was able to rally around him because he was there. Everyone saw him, was able to go to that place. So, for example, if we, something that I'm very interested in is movements, you know, specifically maybe have one dedicated to women who are against feminism. So if you create that platform, then all the women who are against feminism will all go there and rally around that. And, you know, right now I don't see that we have very many. So maybe while there could be very, you know, a lot of women out there who are against it, you just would never know, because there's no outlet for them to gather around. So I think those are the main cons. As being a conservative woman, I don't know necessarily what it would be for liberal women. I do know that whether they realize it or not, you know, the same things that affect us badly affect them badly. Maybe they just aren't aware of it. Like, but yeah, I do think that those are, personally, from what I've seen.
Now, girls in your age group, do you find that a lot of them say that they're liberal? Because I talk to a lot of girls in their 20s and they say, oh, I'm liberal. And then you kind of pick their brain about certain things and you find that they're really not that dedicated. They really don't know that much about politics and you could actually easily sway them in your direction.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is something that I've noticed in a lot of the book bloggers that I used to know, because many of the vast majority of them are young girls in their late teens or early 20s. And many of them will regurgitate what they, you know, are fed, essentially. So from the traditional publishing companies or their favorite authors who are extremely liberal, or, you know, whoever they look up to, the celebrities, the musicians. So it's less about them having independent thought and a mind where they interrogate each of the facts, everything that they're given to, and it's more about them just consuming it as they're giving it without asking questions. So I do see that and notice that, but the problem about convincing them, I think, is they usually become very hostile when you question their beliefs. It's more like you either you believe what I believe and I'll accept you into my circle, or if you try and interrogate what I believe, then I don't want to talk to you. So it's that way, because it's a very emotional way of thinking, the way many of these people think. You know, it's like because they look at most of, you know, for example, the immigrants coming in, the illegal ones even, they're like, oh, they should all stay. It's a very emotional thing. It's because they have empathy for them, but it's not a logical thing. Like they're not thinking about the repercussions, the very negative repercussions that'll have on our country. So,
yeah, that's why they say women aren't the best in politics. And I'd say liberalism is infected with, you know, feminist kind of thinking and female brain kind of ideology, actually.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I went to the Women's March in D.C. and I got kind of like caught in the middle of it. with all the women around me, but just some of the signs, you know, I think they all like discarded their signs in front of the White House, you know, the White House after. So there were like thousands of signs.
And all the men had to come pick it up, right?
Yeah, just some of the signs. It was like feminism is the future, or the future is female, stuff like that, you know, that don't even make any sense.
They just want total female supremacy. They just don't even want guys in the picture. They're not thinking in terms of a healthy union of, you know, males and females. They just want to dominate completely. And I'm sorry, but women dominating completely, I mean, there would be world wars, trust me, the way that women fight.
And I wish that women, and maybe even some men, I don't know, would stop looking at it as men dominate or women dominate. I've always looked at it as we play different roles that should complement each other.
Right.
So we're a team. Like let's look at it as being a team. And if we look at it that way, it's a completely different perspective. It's not like they're on top and we, you know, like controlling everything we do and we're servants or something, you know, we're a team. And I wish that mentality could be normalized again, but we'll see.
Well, tell everyone where they can buy the book. I mean, is it better to buy it through your website or is it only Amazon? Because I heard that a lot of authors don't actually make that much off of Amazon, and I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the greatest, but it's actually, you do make more than you would from traditionally publishing. You do make more royalties. So actually, we link on our website to Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So you can go to our website, but it doesn't make really any difference. But yes, so you can get it online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And then also we have a wonderful audiobook on audible.com. Our narrator is so awesome because he's really versatile with his voices, and he also added like some sound effects and stuff like that. So it's really cool. He did a great job. So if you like audiobooks, definitely check that out. Yes. And then our website is tspettibone.com.
All right. Well, Brittany, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work too.
Thank you so much. I've had a blast.
Thanks to Red Ice members who make this show possible. Don't forget our live TV show on Saturdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time called Weekend Warrior, where we comment on current politics, news, and entertainment. If you're not a member, sign up to watch this show live and chat with fellow members at redicemembers.com. Your membership enables us to produce radio, news, live streams, and TV content. You can also send a donation to paypal.me/redice. We're adding new segments to Red Ice TV, including Norse News, The Blonde Buttermaker, and a spot dedicated to health. That's it for now. Have a great night. See you next time.